there's no more interesting language for me to understand other people who are different more effectively than basketball. There's just no other language. It's true. In the past 5 years, I've played basketball in probably a dozen countries, oftentimes with people who I share no common language. And it's a sport, like any sport, but especially this one, that relies so much on timing and communication and the expectation of what the other person's going to do. And every culture plays it differently. A few summers ago, I spent a good chunk of time in China and a good chunk of time in Taiwan. And the styles there were so different. It was remarkable. Taiwan is much more a shooter's game. I could play that all day. At least where I was in Beijing and Shanghai, it was like a game of power forwards. I was done. I couldn't play with these guys. But, you know, I think that oftentimes, unless the form of communication has some sort of cultural prestige or capital, unless it's like music, right, classical music, if it's not analytic, we often just forget it as a way of communicating. And I think for years, I forgot about basketball.
So I wondered if you could go back a little bit to you were talking about the shift when you got to Swarthmore, really valuing sort of analytic ways of doing things, analytic intelligence. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe a particular moment at Swarthmore where you realized, hey, maybe this isn't sort of the way to go about things, or maybe this isn't the only way to think, or maybe this is, maybe there are other things that I'm sort of missing out on by kind of hyper-focusing on this particular kind of intelligence.
Sure. So when I was a senior, I was, I'd spent my sophomore year abroad at Oxford, and I really loved that environment. I wanted to come back for grad school. So I applied to all the scholarships that are out there for that, and I got a final interview for the Rhodes Scholarship. And I did a lot of research on it, and I read an article that, in retrospect, I wish I had never read. And if you're listening to this podcast, don't go read this article. It's the worst thing that could happen to you. It was a New York Times article from the 1990s, and it was summarizing the experience of people who interview as Rhodes National Finalists. And it described this one young man who was asked the question, if you had 1 minute to talk to the Prime Minister of India about ethnic violence, what would you say? And I thought, oh gosh, all right, I better have 1 minute answers for everything in my field. And I feel, you know, I was a senior in college, so it's pretty broad, right? My range of interests. So, you know, to me, this is like the ultimate fetishization of that sort of superficial intelligence, right? If you had 1 minute to solve the most complex human problem, right, which is how do people with different backgrounds coexist, what would you say? I mean, it's like once someone asked Noam Chomsky, if you had 1 minute to convince George W. Bush to end the Iraq war, what would you say? And Chomsky said, you know, no, you've totally misunderstood my political critique. You know, I think that foreign policy essentially is, you know, a matter of all these structural forces well beyond the control of this particular president. So if I had 1 minute, I'd just ask him, like, has God said anything too interesting, you know, lately? And, you know, so that's how I feel about this sort of question. But at the time I was thinking, wow, I really have to prove, you know, how cerebral I am. So I developed all these 1 minute your responses that were totally ridiculous, incredibly pompous, highly unuseful, wouldn't have reduced ethnic conflict if anyone had ever asked me. And then I got to the Rhodes interview, and you know, it turns out most of the questions they asked me were kind of interested in deep personal introspection. They didn't care how much I knew about ethnic conflict in India. They cared how much I knew myself. And I realized that about 10 minutes after the interview ended. And I realized, wow, this was miserable. I've worked so hard to convince these people that I have this certain sort of intelligence that our culture obsesses over. But the truth is they didn't care, right? They just assumed, well, yeah, if you get called in for final round interview to do a graduate program at Oxford, you know, you're probably competent in your field. So we don't care about that. What we care is, can you use that competence in a way that helps other people? And to do that, you have to know yourself pretty well. And I think I came across as, you know, someone who didn't know myself. And that was really, that was a moment of reckoning for me. I very much did not get that scholarship. And it made me think, you know, not only, okay, maybe I didn't get this because I was too consumed with fetishizing a certain sort of intelligence, but also maybe I wanted this because I was too busy fetishizing a certain sort of intelligence. And I remember thinking, you know, winning the scholarship would have made me really happy. I would have been very proud, but it wouldn't have made me a better writer. It wouldn't have made me a better friend. It wouldn't have made me better at any of the things that I really wanted to get better at. And I ended up having a year where I didn't go to grad school, and I had a lot of time to discover new things about myself. And then on a different scholarship, I ended up doing the same program that I wanted to do at Oxford. And it was a much, much better experience because I knew myself better. I knew what I wanted. And I wasn't there trying to prove how intelligent I was. I was there trying to continue to get to know myself in better ways.